Okay. Thanks. Pleasure to be here. What I'm going to talk about today, I'll just write down the title. And this is based on work with John Lofton and Xingtong Yao. Okay, so the idea is that it has been fruitful in string theory and in mirror symmetry to go to push things as far as you can and go to a limit. For example, orbifold models are something where you push a smooth space to the limit where it develops a singularity, but there it actually becomes useful to study things. And often flat space is some limit, large radius limit of the smooth space, and that's where you can learn things. And the idea is to study, is to apply this to mirror symmetry and study Calabi-Yau threefolds at the so-called large complex structure limit point, of their moduli space. This is where mirror symmetry happens. Usually it happens in a neighborhood, but what can you say actually at that point? Try to describe it and prove something. About the conjectural structure there. And that's what I'll do today. First, let me describe a little bit what we would expect at that point. So I'll remind you that if you have a pair of Calabi-Yau threefolds that are mirror, it's fruitful to consider the brains that you have there. So I'll assume some familiarity with that. In particular, if I consider the so-called B brains on M, they correspond to holomorphic submanifolds. And there's a distinguished one, which is just the point. And it should have some mirror T. Which should be a Lagrangian submanifold of M tilde. And if we look at the moduli space of that brain, well, since this point can live anywhere in M, it looks like that. Its moduli space is M, and so we can find the mirror of M tilde by identifying this T and looking at its moduli space. That's sort of the idea. And if that's true, then the moduli space of T, which should equal the manifold M, which could be any Calabi-Yau which is involved in mirror symmetry, that has some structure. If this is a supersymmetric brain, then it has data that it's a special Lagrangian submanifold. And so given the brain, I can just think of it as a submanifold, and then I get this map from the moduli of this, of the brain's T to the moduli of special Lagrangian submanifolds. And this extra data on that brain, which is a U1 bundle, and the choice of moduli for that U1 bundle is a torus, not the same T, maybe S1, the B1 of T. For each homology cycle, you can give a phase for that U1 bundle. So this simple picture leads you to the conjecture that a Calabi-Yau involved in mirror symmetry has a torus vibration over this kind of moduli space. Yeah, T is going to be some special Lagrangian inside M tilde. Yes, this will be, I'm going to do everything in three complex dimensions for the complex things and three real dimensions for the Lagrangian things. So there are some other lessons that we can learn from this, is that the point is small compared to M. Well, at large radius limit, that's a limit where M gets very large, or we can think of the point as getting very small in comparison to M. And the dual of that means that T should become small. So we get small fibers at a large complex structure limit. The other thing that we get is that if you look at the moduli space of D brains, well, it's this moduli space of special Lagrangians with their flat bundles, there's a natural metric which appears here. And the natural metric is flat on the fibers. We don't expect that to be the actual metric. The actual metric should receive corrections. For example, if you think of calculating the metric by making a computation in the boundary conformal field theory that the D-brain defines, you have corrections due to instantons. Those would be disk instantons. But barring disk instantons, we have a flat metric on the fibers. The strength of those corrections will be related to the size of the disks. And as long as none of the fibers collapse, then you can't have a disk because you won't be able to contract this loop. You can only contract this loop as you get closer and closer to a point where the fiber becomes singular. So if you're far away from the singular fibers, you expect some kind of behavior like this. And in fact, so this is what you expect that in the Gromov-Hausdorff limit, actually the fibers collapse and we're only left with the base, which should look like moduli of special Lagrangians. Let me call B the base. And this should actually hold geometrically away from singularities. The point, let me put in the other submanifold, which is M, and that would be dual to some rigid special Lagrangian sphere. And in the limit of large radius, this becomes much more massive than this. So this should become much more massive than that. And this is the fiber, and this is, well, conjecturally, the base. So the base should become much bigger than the fibers at that limit. Okay. So what we expect is that in the limit where the fibers collapse, the Calabi-Yau shrinks to some three-dimensional space, and that actually has the geometric structure that the moduli space of special Lagrangians have. So let me remind you, or tell you, what that structure, what the geometric structure on special Lagrangian moduli spaces. In fact, it's a Hessian manifold. Hitchin proved this. We're describing the geometric structure that we expect from the limiting space, namely B. A large complex structure limit, we expect the Calabi-Yau to reduce to a three-dimensional space.
Can you say a few words about how that marginal space is special and non-dual?
Yes. Okay, let me define for you special Lagrangian. We're in the situation where we have a Calabi-Yau, which is a Kähler manifold. So we have a Kähler form, and we have a holomorphic free form. Trivial canonical bundle means that there's a unique holomorphic free form, and I can take the imaginary part of it and the real part of it. Special Lagrangian, the submanifold L, where am I, M tilde, is special Lagrangian if the pullback of the Kähler form and the pullback of the imaginary part of omega are zero. The way you define a moduli space is by starting with one and looking nearby and to see if you have a smooth space of deformations. So you start out with a special Lagrangian and then you take a vector field, and you look at deformations of it. And so you get a map from identifying a tubular neighborhood of special Lagrangian. You get a map from sections of the normal bundle, given a section of the normal bundle, namely a deformation vector field, you can take the pullback of omega of this map F. And then you see that the nearby special Lagrangian submanifolds are the zeros of F. And you use an implicit function theorem to show that the zeros of F are a smooth space. So that you have, if you're at a smooth special Lagrangian, you're at a regular point of this map. That defines the moduli space locally. Does that answer the question? The dimension of this moduli space, so if you look at the linearization, it corresponds to, you can make a one form out of this V by using the complex structure, and that becomes a one form on the special Lagrangian. And the linearization is that it's closed. That means it preserves the Lagrangian condition, and preserving the special condition means that that's true. So we can identify the deformations with harmonic one forms, which is why the dimension is actually the same as the dimension of the fiber. And in fact, not only that, but the tangent space is canonically identified with the vector space from which we construct this torus, and that gives us an almost complex structure a priori. And so, the fibers should collapse to a point.
And this other moduli space we have here, the
yeah, that's the data of the special Lagrangian plus the data of a U1 bundle of fixed curvature. Where if there's no B field, then the curvature is zero. So flat U1 bundle.
So these three manifolds, like you get
I can't give you global information about these. About what type? Oh, the T should be a torus. Sorry. The T should be a torus. Yeah. I thought you were asking about these. Okay. So let me give you now what the geometric structure that Hitchin found in this space. Well, because we have omega, we can actually construct periods by taking the integral of omega over one cycle, which gives us one forms on the moduli space. And using this, and the fact that those one forms are closed, yields there's distinguished coordinates, and they're actually Hessian coordinates. Let me tell you what that means. It means that the natural metric on this moduli space, which is just actually the metric on harmonic forms, which varies over the moduli space because the metric will vary, the induced metric will vary. The metric on the moduli space is given by the Hessian of a function. Let me call these UI and UJ. And in fact, there's an affine structure. So if you use different one-forms to define your periods, let me just write U, then you'll get different coordinates, but those coordinates will differ by an affine transformation. So lambda element SL N and B constant. So we have what's known as an affine manifold. And in fact, you can reconstruct the Calabi-Yau by doing the following construction. This is actually in NZ. So you can take, given a B of this type, given a manifold of this type, you can take the tangent space of that manifold and quotient by a lattice inside the tangent space, which is the lattice generated by the tangent vectors associated to that coordinate. Now, if you go to a new patch, this lattice might change, but if lambda lives in SLNZ, then in fact it's the same lattice. So this lattice is globally defined, and this makes sense. And it fibers over B with torus fibers. So you can sort of reconstruct you can reconstruct a Calabi-Yau in this way. And by defining coordinates zj equals uj plus ivj, and take the same function phi, which is a function of just the real part of z, so it's a function of z and z bar, and use this as a Kähler potential, then the equation of Ricci flatness. I'm using the same phi. Sorry. That's right. U is expressed in terms of Z and Z bar. So, sorry about that. This will be Ricci flat. Well, you know the Ricci flat equation for phi, but you can express it just as an equation for U if the determinant is constant, which I can rescale to 1. So in this way, given this data, you can reconstruct a Calabi-Yau metric with a special Lagrangian torus vibration where the fibers are flat. So in, yeah, this is an honest vibration with no singular fibers. So singular fibers are going to be the whole question here. And we think of the flat torus vibration as sort of a starting point where we haven't included the disk instanton correction. Okay, so I'm going to be studying spaces of that type. But now if we think about what should actually be happening, well, the Calabi-Yaus are simply connected and we can't really have torus fibers. There has to be some singular fibers. So we expect the picture to look like this. And this is a picture which was developed by Mark Gross and Weirong Ruan. That the clavia has some vibration, torus vibration, and as you approach large complex structure limit, there's some singular set, singular fibers, and at the limit, it becomes codimension 2, and actually a graph. So this is a picture of B, and this is a picture of some singular set inside of B, where the fibers become singular. Now, as I write some examples of solutions to this equation, which is called the Monge-Ampère equation, you'll see that it's not too hard to construct solutions. Well, it's not so easy, but it's not all that hard to construct solutions that don't have any singular fibers. And in fact, by looking in 2 plus 1 dimensions, it's not too hard to construct solutions near some point where there is a singular fiber, but there's monodromy. But nothing is known, well, yet, until the end of the talk, about here. So that's what we're going to be looking at, trying to solve this equation to get a kind of starting point for putting together a Calabi-Yau, to find a semi-flat Calabi-Yau metric with a torus vibration, where the torus has singularities in a Y-shaped vertex. Semi-flat means the fibers are flat. And if you do this because the Kähler potential is only chosen to depend on U and not to depend on V, this will have a flat fibers. Yes. That's right. Exactly. I'm going to find a solution to the Monge-Ampère equation in the neighborhood of a solution that has singularities in the neighborhood of a point where the singularity structure looks like that. In the one-dimensional case, this I can take the product of a complex two-dimension cross complex line here, and I'll write down an example like that. Okay, let me put this picture. Now there's another vertex which has become in favor, called the topological vertex, and this is not the same as that. The topological vertex does correspond to some torus vibration over an octant, but there's no way of going around. The octant has walls, and you can't go around them. So to distinguish this vertex from that vertex, I've called it Y for the letter Y, which it looks like. Okay. Let me first just throw some examples of solutions at you. Take phi to depend on one variable, which itself depends on three variables. These are going to be examples of the type of that check mark. The first one was found long ago by Calabi. If I put C here, then the determinant of the Hessian is actually C and not 1, but that's good enough. And the reason why I put C is because if you take C equals 0 here, then you just have the integral, if you take C equals 0, you just have the integral let me get rid of C entirely. Okay. Sorry about that. So these other things are not always so easy to find, but here's a few of them that we found. Okay, so there's three examples. It's not a particularly robust set, but it's some evidence that you can solve the equation. Yeah. With respect to t, just the antiderivative with respect to t. It's just a function of t. Thank you. Here, just solutions. Just solutions. We don't know. Yeah, smooth solutions. In some neighborhood. For example, for this one, I need t less than 0. I need absolute value of c greater than t. Otherwise, I still have a solution, but what I want is that the Hessian is a positive matrix. So this is the condition for this one, that the Hessian is a positive matrix. Here's another solution. This has axial symmetry. The first one had rotational symmetry. These are numbers, 3 and 2. This is a Weierstrass P function of all things to the minus 1/3 power, where tau is the modulus of an elliptic curve in Weierstrass form that has g2 equals 0 and g3 less than 0. Turns out to be real, and this is a real function. And it solves the equations. Okay, so it's a solution to the Monge-Ampère equation. Sorry? You see, I raised the if and only if. So probably it can be linear in the variables. The analog of holomorphic plus anti-holomorphic, I think, will be, because those are solutions to the Laplace equation, the analog will be linear functions, which are solutions to second derivative equals 0. So in so I think that would suffice to still give a Ricci flat. But this is the solution. This is the equation that I'm solving. Okay, let me give you a more robust class of solutions that appears in two dimensions and was known for some time but was rediscovered in the context of string theory by considering a torus vibration where the modulus of the torus depends on two variables. Or on a complex variable. Then the solutions of the equations of motion of string theory for the effective theory say that if that modulus is holomorphic, then you expect a solution. And indeed, you can find a solution. You can find a Ricci flat torus vibration in this case. So let me show you that solution. Take the antiderivative of the function tau with respect to z. Take the antiderivative of that. This modulus of the torus. Chi is the antiderivative of phi. Phi is the antiderivative of tau. These are functions. And I'm taking the tau to depend on some complex domain. And I'm going to give you new coordinates for that domain. U1 is going to be the real part of z. U2 is going to be minus the real part of phi. So that defines u in terms of z. And you can therefore also, it's invertible, you can find z in terms of u. So phi of z of u is the imaginary part of chi minus the imaginary part of z times the real part of phi. This actually solves the Mongin paracord. And in the case where tau looks like the logarithm, then when you it has a singularity at zero, and when you go around the singularity, there's monodrum. So K3 manifolds, elliptic K3 manifolds, have the structure of a torus vibration like this. With singular points. Generically, there would be 24 singular points. And we decided that this should be a good picture of the large complex structure limit of a Calabi-Yau, namely a semi-flat vibration, as long as you avoid the singular fibers. So Gross and Wilson studied I was going to distinguish it from Gromov-Witten by the second letter, but I can't do that. I can't do it. Anyway, Mark Gross and Pelham Wilson studied K3 metric approaching a limit point. And found that it limits to something which is very close to this metric here in these neighborhoods. But around these points, we needed the Uguri-Vafa metric. Which is another metric for a elliptic vibration with a, with monodromy. It's not this metric that we construct here. But it can be thought of as starting, as using this as a starting point and incorporating disk instantons in a way that is mysterious. Big mystery about this Uguri-Vafa metric. It's just a solution that once you have it, you can use it in nice ways and prove something about the limiting structure of K3. Maybe a word is in order that to explain that this vibration is holomorphic, but I've defined new real coordinates on the base, and if I reconstructed the semi-flat vibration as U1 plus IV1, U2 plus IV2, then I go to a different complex structure where what was a holomorphic vibration becomes a special Lagrangian vibration. And yet we use holomorphicity in some in making this construction. That's a bit of a mystery as well. I think probably what's more important is to think of this tau as a harmonic map rather than a holomorphic map. Yes? No, but it can be written as this plus other terms, which look like instanton corrections. Yeah. It cannot be written in terms of phi. It can be written in terms of a function which looks like phi plus other terms. No, it's not of this form. It's right. I mean, all I can do is add a few more of these question marks. There's an interesting question about what happens to holomorphic curves as we, or you, approach this large complex structure point. The holomorphic curves, if they have any part that's in the fibers, that part should collapse as well. and they should turn into one-dimensional things that live in base. So somehow there might be some way of using the integer affine structure that we've seen should exist in this base to account for all the holomorphic curves. So this is an area of study which probably will relate to tropical geometry that Mikalkin has been pursuing. I have nothing to say about that. What I'm going to do is just try to prove the existence of a solution to this Monge-Ampère equation in the neighborhood of a singular point. Okay, so long introduction. That one cross C will produce a cylinder. So this is sort of the fundamental non-trivial piece. Just the way the Ugori-Vatha metric was the fundamental non-trivial piece. In fact, we can't do as good as Ugori-Vatha because Ugori-Vatha is not semi-flat and it incorporates distance and time. But somehow what we want to do is a three-dimensional analog of this case that has monodromy. Okay. So let me discuss affine differential geometry. Certain affine manifolds, namely manifolds with patches and affine transition functions, arise by studying hypersurfaces in affine space. Just like certain complex manifolds arise by studying hypersurfaces in complex space. Having properties invariant under affine transformations. For example, our equation of interest describes manifolds known as parabolic, equi-affine spheres. Let me explain what that means. So we're going to do some geometry of hypersurfaces. We have a hypersurface. And we choose some normal. Normally you would choose if you're looking at a hypersurface in Euclidean space, the natural normal to choose would be something perpendicular. But affine space means we don't have a metric. So we can't do that. The equi means that we have a volume, so we have a sense of volume, but we don't have a metric. So there's no notion of perpendicularity. And anyway, a sphere has the property that all the perpendicular normals come from an original point. But if you do an affine transformation on it and then look at the perpendicular normals, it's no longer true. So we want to define a sphere in the affine sense using a different normal. First of all, I can't construct perpendicularity, so I have to do something else. So you use something called the equi-affine normal, which only uses the equi-affine structure. The way to do it, here's a tangent plane. Here's a displaced tangent plane. Here's a volume which has some center of mass. I don't know there. And now take this displacement and let it get smaller and smaller and track the center of mass and take the derivative of that track. And that will give you a vector. Suitably normalized, you get what's known as the equiaffine normal. So here's my hypersurface. F is going to be the mass into Euclidean space. And the way we do differential geometry is we use the fact that we have a flat connection on Euclidean space so we can differentiate vectors. What is, what, affine? What is phi? Phi is a function. It's this function that solves the Monge-Ampère equation. The solutions to the Monge-Ampère equation will describe parabolic affine spheres. I haven't defined parabolic affine sphere yet, so let me do that, and then I'll get to that. Okay. So the way you do differential geometry is you actually differentiate vectors, and you get a piece which is tangent. These are tangent vectors to the manifold. When you differentiate one vector by another, you will get a piece which is tangent to the manifold, and that defines the induced connection, plus a piece which is normal, which will define the second fundamental form. Plus you can differentiate the normal vector, and same thing. You get a piece which is tangent, which will be some function of x, plus a normal piece like that. Now, what happens if you take a unit perpendicular and you differentiate it? Then you know that its derivative is perpendicular to itself, so this part goes away in ordinary space. And if you choose this equiaffine normal in this clever way and normalize it appropriately, then this becomes zero for equiaffine normal. How will we define a sphere? A sphere will be a hypersurface like this, where all the normals come from the same place, come to the same point. And that point can exist on the inside or on the outside, or we allow it to exist at infinity as well. And that will distinguish between parabolic spheres, elliptic spheres, and hyperbolic affine spheres. The second fundamental form becomes a metric when we talk about spheres. This operator becomes a multiple of the identity, and that multiple being 1, 1 minus 1 or 0, according to elliptic, hyperbolic, and parabolic. Since I'm talking about parabolic, this will be 0 for a parabolic sphere. And this is the induced connection, which is called the affine connection. If we were doing differential geometry, using the ordinary normal, we would get the Levi-Civita connection. Epsilon equals plus is elliptic. Oh. I don't know how to... I can only draw, like, well, this would be elliptic, and this would be hyperbolic. There's another condition which also comes from using the equi part, namely the volume part, which is that volume of U wedge, the dual of the normal, should equal volume of Rm. So these are the equations. And let me fulfill my promise. This promise is true in any dimensions, but I'm going to do it in two dimensions. Suppose U1, U2 goes to U1, U2, phi is a solution of these equations. So let's check it. Let's see what that means. All right, first of all, what I need to do is I need to take a tangent vector, and I now have to push it into 3 space. So the push forward will be ti plus phi I in the third direction. That's how you push forward a vector. And this says to take 2 tangent vectors and take the derivative of one with respect to the other, that equals, well, this vector acting on dj plus phi j d3, which is clearly phi I j d3. And this is equal to this plus this. I'm going to take C to be equal to d3. Parabolic affine sphere says this is 0 and this is 0. So C is constant along the sphere. And so we're going to just put it in the z direction. So this means that del is 0. This equation means that that part is 0. And hij, the metric, is equal to phi ij. So the induced metric is indeed Hessian. And finally, let me look at the last equation there. Says that the volume that phi ij d1 d2 wedge the dual of the normal should equal the volume of R3, which is true if the determinant is equal to 1. Okay? And this construction is invertible. So given a solution like this, you can construct a parabolic affine sphere solving these equations in that way. The property that the affine normals all come from a single point is invariant if I make an affine transformation. So the affine normals behave in an affine way, and then they'll still emerge from a single point. The property is invariant. Yeah, not the space. The property is invariant. Yeah. So it's a well-defined property. Okay, so now let me do some triage. Okay. So turns out the flat connection D amounts to an integrability condition for finding F. Namely, if you can solve these equations, you get, if you impose flatness, you get equations for the metric and this connection. And if you can solve them, you can reconstruct the map F. Let me give you a hint of how that works. So in two dimensions, if I take the difference between my affine connection and the Levi-Civita connection, which I can construct from a metric, this is an honest tensor. called the pick form. And I can use the metric to make it a 3-0 tensor. I can do a little bit more. Since I have a Riemannian metric in two dimensions, it means I have a complex structure. And I might as well choose complex coordinates so that the metric has this form. If you do that, this tensor actually becomes a cubic differential. So you can write the connection in terms of the metric and this function u. And then you plug in these equations. So what do these equations look like? You take a basis, which looks like c. The derivative of your map f with respect to z, and the derivative of your map f with respect to z bar. This is a frame of vectors, and you can look at the derivative of a vector. That's what this equation here says. Write the derivatives of a vector in terms of the connection. We've written that in terms of u and h. We've written that in terms of psi. This equals, well, something like C, Z bar, F Z bar, plus, that's a component of the Levi-Civita connection. So Levi-Civita, and then this is form C. What I've done is I've written this part, plus the metric. Well, the metric has no ZZ part, so there's zero here. And since C is just the raised index, I can write that in terms of U as such. So you have that, you have this complex conjugate of that, and you have something which is like FZZ bar equals, and here you just get the metric. So what we've learned is dz of this frame equals some matrix times that frame itself. So you can rewrite, these are all vectors, so you can rewrite them in terms of that frame itself. And we've just learned what the matrix is. Call that matrix M. And M tells you how to differentiate the frame in the Z direction. So let me use shorthand for the frame. We have that equation. And you can do a similar thing for D bar. You get some other matrix N. And then you impose dd bar of v equals d bar d of v. And you get equations for m and n. The equation is dn plus nm equals d bar m plus mn. So you go through that exercise and rewrite that equation, and it becomes the following thing. D bar u is 0. And this equation there. So u actually, so the data now to solve the equations is going to be a holomorphic cubic differential, which is something kind of that you can do, that you can understand globally. And this equation here, which maybe is familiar to some people, if you try to study scalar curvature deformations to give prescribed curvature, sorry, conformal deformations to give prescribed scalar curvature in two dimensions is this equation. Okay. So that's the equation for a parabolic affine sphere. And more generally, an affine sphere is given by this equation in two dimensions. The epsilon will depend on parabolic or hyperbolic or elliptic. The del is the Laplacian with respect to a metric e to the psi times g naught, where g naught is some, sorry, the del is the Laplacian with respect to g naught, where g naught is some background metric. So now what I've done is I've taken this equation and I've written it more globally. This makes sense globally now. I have hybrid notation. Thank you. So this equation is the one that we want to solve now. Oh, sorry. So this equation when epsilon equals zero gives me a parabolic affine sphere. In fact, I'm going to want to find elliptic affine spheres for the following reason. I was going for 1 hour. And then I was going to stop, but maybe it's less than an hour. For 1 hour. Okay. So I'm almost done. Fact. As in Euclidean space, I'll start abbreviating, where the flat metric is the cone over the metric on a sphere, a cone over an elliptic affine sphere is a parabolic affine sphere. It's not quite as trivial. The elliptic affine spheres solve this equation. Determinant of the Hessian of U equals u to the minus n plus 2. So sort of doing an argument similar to what we did before, x goes to 1 over u x. Now, to make a cone, you introduce a coordinate r, and you multiply the map by that coordinate, a radial coordinate. In this way, if I call this thing y, these coordinates y, y is given in terms of r and x, and likewise you can solve for r in terms of y. Now magically, if you take phi equals 1 half r of y squared, this solves the Mangin-Pair equation. Kind of magical. The coordinates, this solves an equation in coordinates u, this solves the equation in coordinates y, and it works out nicely that way. Okay. So the problem is to solve the equation for the elliptic affine sphere, epsilon equals 1, on a 2-sphere with 3 points removed. Take a cone over it, and you get a parabolic affine sphere, namely a solution of Mangin-Pair equation, on the cone over the 2-sphere, which is a, like that. Now it has a y-vertex singularity. So that's the problem. You use local analysis to to look at what the behavior of psi, the singular behavior of psi, must be near these points on the sphere. And that's, you can do that. And then you try to prove the existence of a solution to this equation with that prescribed singularity on the sphere. And the key to it is, let me sort of end my talk and then I'll write down the functional. So that's it. That's all we do is we write down a functional whose minimum solves the solution. And then the hard part is to prove that the functional has the minimum. The hard part is that these signs appear in different signs, and it makes it hard to construct, if you've tried to solve PDEs, super solutions or subsolutions, or it even makes it hard to write down a functional. So then, well, it's probably not worth it to write down a function. It's kind of long, so only if you're interested. But that's how we solve the solution. You can cook up a functional, which is sort of it's a little more than tweaking, but it sort of uses the same ideas that you might use to write down a functional to solve this Yamabe problem in two dimensions. And then you show that the functional has a minimum. The minimum solves this equation, defines the elliptic affine sphere. The cone over that defines a parabolic affine sphere. Because of the singularity structure, you get monodromy around these points, and you have what you were looking for. A semi-flat, Ricci-flat Calabi-Yau metric in the neighborhood of the Y-vertex. So I'll stop at that. Yeah, we take I think it's in terms of a coordinate z where u equals has three poles of order 2, so it's a cubic differential on a sphere has to have 6 poles, so since we want 3, we take 3 poles of order 2. Then psi has to have the form log z, log has the value of log z over z. Plus, you can be a little bit more precise about subleading terms. So that's sort of the form that it takes. And if you look, that has a residue, and you'll see that because of the three poles, the integral of the Laplacian of, call this thing psi naught, and then psi equals psi naught plus rho. And then the integral of the Laplacian of psi naught will be 6 pi. And then rho is going to be the smooth, well, in not exactly smooth, but L2-1 function that you look for. Yeah, z will be a coordinate near the singularity. So we would choose a background metric which is actually flat at the singularity, a coordinate such that u exactly looks like this in the neighborhood of the singularity, and then the leading behavior of the solution will look like that. Yeah? No, we take a cone.
Oh, yeah,
that's right. Other questions? Yeah, so u has to satisfy some inequality for the solution to persist. But yes, there's a range of u which gives a solution. That's right, there's that modulus. I don't know exactly how different those solutions are, but I don't know.
Well, there are no solutions for large u or
no, there's a finite range of values of u that gives solutions. No, not finite number of, there's a range of continuous range of u that gives solutions. Yes, Lena? No. I don't. We haven't proved that. Haven't proved that it's unique. And we haven't actually constructed what the monodromy is around it. But. Yes, there's singularities, and there's an affine structure, and the affine structure has some monodromy when you go around the singularities. But we haven't constructed that. Yes, we have a functional that has bounded functional that has an actual minimum. So there exists a solution. I wish I could write it down more explicitly, but that's the solution? Yeah, it would take more than a minute to write it down. So. That's a good question. In the simple case that I checked, it doesn't seem to. But I'm not sure about that. The simple case I checked was the parabolic case, so I don't know. It's a big question. I'd love to be able to arrange you to prove that the monodrome is integer valued. And then, I was going to ask you about it. Okay, maybe that's a good place to stop.
Two types of